Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. You are listening to Voices for Justice today, November 4th, 2009. For the next hour, we will explore the Amanda Knox case. I'm Michelle Bart, your host for today. Our guests will be taking your calls in a little while. Please call in. The call-in number is 347-838-8622. Again, that number is 347-838-8622. And in a little while, all the guests will take your calls. You can also post your questions in our live chat, and we'll get to all the questions as possible. Just log on to blogtalkradio.com/helpingheroes. Today, we have Larry Kobolinski, Dr. Dale Archer, and Ann Bremner with us. We'll also hear from a couple members of Amanda's family. Dr. Kobolinski has been at John Jay College since September of 1975. He has served as a consultant to CBS and many other news network programs on issues related to forensic science. He is also on the United States Department regarding forensic science laboratories in the Ukraine. He is a diplomat of the American College of Forensic Examiners and is a board-certified forensic examiner. Today we have Dr. Kobolinski with us. We also have Dr. Dale Archer, who will be with us momentarily. Dr. Dale Archer is a medical doctor, board-certified psychiatrist, and distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, who has helped thousands of patients for more than two decades. He is also a regular on Headline News' Issues with Jane Velez and host of the Dale Archer Show that can be seen on Fox and CW. We welcome Dr. Dale Archer back with us today. We also have Ann Bremner, who is a college graduate of Stanford University and the University of Puget Sound School of Law. She's an attorney. She has been seen as a regular on Headline News' Nancy Grace. Ann Bremner is a former director of media and public relations of Washington Women Lawyers. She is an attorney in the Seattle, Washington area. And she has become one of the biggest voices for justice for Amanda Knox. Just to bring our listeners up to date, Amanda Knox is from Washington State, a great, great young lady who arrived in Italy in mid-September of 2007 to attend the University for Foreigners. She found a living situation in a cottage, which she shared with two young Italian women and Meredith Kircher, a British student. And today we're going to be speaking with all of our guests, including Amanda's family members, to find out how Amanda's doing and how we all can have a voice for justice in this case. Is everybody with us?
Yep. I'm here. It's Ann.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Ann. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us. And do we also have Chris and Janet with us?
Yes, you do.
Yes, I'm here. This is Christina.
Hi, Christina, and we also have Janet. Both are family members of Amanda's, and I guess let's start with all of you. How is the family and Amanda holding up through all of this?
Oh, my goodness. Well, my husband just got back from being with her for about a month, and know, all of his updates and when he'd tell the rest of us how she's doing. She's holding her own. She's really tired of being there and this whole ordeal, and she worries an awful lot about the rest of us more than herself. She keeps reiterating, I'm fine, it'll be okay. She just worries about her mom and her dad and her sisters and, you know, the rest of the family more than anything.
Anne, can you bring listeners up a little bit about what legal ramifications they had in this particular case? I believe this crime was done, what, on November 2nd, 2007?
What, and you're talking about the ramifications if there's a conviction or about what's happened so far?
The ramifications to the fact that there's a what we all believe is an innocent young lady sitting behind bars for a crime that there's nothing to show, at least me, and I'm not a law professional or anything, but I don't see any evidence to show that this young lady did anything.
Well, and you're exactly right, and I wanted to say I'm honored to be on today also with Christina and Janet and Larry and Dale. I mean, this is a case where there is no evidence, and in fact, Amanda Knox was held for a year, where she would be held only 72 hours in the United States without being charged. And this case, if it was tried in the U.S., would not have involved an indictment or charging in my mind and in the minds of many. And then beyond that, she's gone through this very publicized trial where there's not any evidence to link her. There's that saying that, you know, evidence, witnesses can and do lie, they can be mistaken, but the evidence never lies. And in this case, there's no evidence to connect her at all, and yet she sits in jail in Italy and faces the rest of her life in prison there and at hard labor.
What on November 2nd, 2007, in Italy, she saw nothing wrong with the house. She went in, took a shower, left. The door of her roommate was closed, and most of us would assume that, you know, your roommate is sleeping, so you leave. And then all of a sudden, she comes back to find this horrific, horrific situation in the room after police, which I read on one of your sites, the police got there because a cell phone was found somewhere.
Right, and I think any of your listeners should take a look at, we have a Friends of Amanda site and also an Amanda Defense Fund site, but on Friends of Amanda, you can go through all of the evidence there. But this is a situation where she saw nothing truly amiss. You know, her ends up that her roommate's murdered, and frankly, she decided, of course, as the right thing to do, to cooperate, and it appears that the authorities, you know, after talking to her for 41 hours in one session for 14 in Italian when she doesn't speak Italian without a translator and without a lawyer, tried to browbeat her into saying something, which they never got. It's just it was a travesty from the beginning and all the way to the end in terms of that investigation.
Yeah, Michelle, this is Christina. Can I clarify something here?
Yeah,
sure. It was reported early on, and there were photos that were released of the bathroom, and it looked like a bloody mess, and people were going, well, how is it that she could walk in there and not know what was going on? But when Amanda walked into that bathroom, there was nothing. All of those photos that were leaked and put out to the press that really looked horrific were all of the, you know, juvenile and whatever the police and the forensic went in to test for evidence and collect evidence, where what Amanda saw was really nothing. I mean, there was maybe a smudge that possibly somebody could have cut their finger, and that's why, you know, she really wasn't at first concerned. I mean, it seemed odd, but nothing was really out of place.
Right. I mean, how many of us walk into a bathroom or have utilized our own bathrooms and we've cut our finger or cut ourselves shaving or something of that nature? So I wouldn't have thought anything either. So I can understand why she just did what she did, came home, took a shower, left, and moved on. And you're right. The pictures, I didn't see the photos in regards to the bathroom, but I did see the photos in regards to the bedroom. Mm-hmm. And, again, I can't say, I'm not a forensic expert. We'll let Dr. Kobolinski speak in a few minutes. But, you know, there's no way in heck that somebody could do a crime that they're accusing her of and be able to leave that scene without leaving something behind, even if it's a strand of hair.
Absolutely. And that's something that they always say in a homicide, is that the one involved leaves something behind and takes something with them. And there's not one trace, not one hair follicle, not any DNA, no blood, no fingerprints of Amanda Knox in that room.
And
now,
and this whole notion...
Go ahead, Christina.
I'm sorry, this whole notion that there is a bloody footprint of Amanda in the hallway is completely false. I mean, that's been leaked out there and reported on that, oh, there's her footprint, and it's not Amanda's. It was testified in court, and they could not determine whose it was. All the footprints in Meredith's room were Rudy's, and there was no footprints of Amanda in the hallway in blood.
Well, unfortunately, though, as we've seen in many cases, even here in America, the things being leaked and the things that media end up reporting on are things that are leaked from the own investigators. And, you know, here we are with a young lady and her boyfriend still behind bars and not knowing their fate due to somebody's fabrications, in my estimate. But let's move into the situation of that room. It was very horrific to see that on television. And, again, what she's being accused of doing does not seem to mesh with the fact that there is no forensics. Dr. Kobolinski, how could somebody go into a room? Now, there's three people accused here, if I'm not mistaken. There was one other gentleman that's already serving time, and then Raphael and Amanda. For them to do all of this and only one person's DNA left behind, is that possible?
Well, first, thank you for inviting me onto the program. The individual that you're referring to, Rudy Guidi, apparently had left behind a handprint in the victim's blood on a pillow that was found underneath the body of Meredith Kircher. That is pretty solid, strong evidence that points in his direction. Of course, he has been subjected to a rapid trial. He's been convicted and sentenced to 30 years. I understand that he'll be appealing that shortly. Now, as for this case, I mean, clearly most cases are based on circumstantial evidence. And as I understand it, and I did see the crime scene tapes, this was a bloody scene. The bedroom was quite bloody. What crime scene investigators set out to do is identify physical evidence, identify it, and then determine the source. And nowadays, DNA is the way to go. That's the gold standard, and it's very critical for human identification. This case is especially complicated because the suspect, Amanda, lived in the cottage. So it is not a surprise that you find her DNA in various places in the cottage. And it may be on the floor, it may be on utensils, it may be on items of furniture, and it may be on various pieces of physical evidence. It is the interpretation that is critical. Why, you know, how did her DNA end up getting on a particular item? How do you explain it? How do you reconstruct that? So the issue is, as far as I can determine, is, you know, did the crime scene people do the analysis properly? I think there were issues with that. And number two, if Amanda's DNA was found on certain items of evidence, how did it get there? What does it mean? What is the significance of that? Was the testing done correctly? Was the description, was the testimony done correctly? Were there techniques used that are somewhat questionable? And how do you interpret the whole thing? Again, this is a complicated matter. As a scientist, I always try not to take sides and just talk about what the science indicates. But, you know, there was hair evidence. There was the hair of an African person's hair found in the hand of Meredith Kircher, as I understand it. And there is luminol testing, that is a presumptive test for blood, and various items, footprints, bare footprints, shoe prints, that really need to be explained properly if we are to reconstruct the events. And I think I'm going to stop here and, you know, wait for questions that you might have.
And in regards to all of that, those forensics and DNA, I would assume that the African American's hair that was found in the hand of Meredith would have been Rudy's. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, but I think I'd like to hear more from Dr. Kowalinski on all of the forensics in this case, because one of the things that I've really found notable is the actual investigation of the crime scene itself. A bra clasp that was considered to be important wasn't collected for 47 days. The methods used by the investigators were, to say the least, different than what we've seen here in the United States as a gold standard of investigation. There was potential for cross-contamination there at the scene. And as I understand it from the trial itself, the forensic experts for the defense said that the footprints of Amanda Knox were not in blood, that a footprint that was attributed or was stated to be that of Raffaele Solicito was really a footprint of Rudy Gadea, the other individual who's been convicted in this case. So there are a lot of issues like that. There's been no demonstration of definitive evidence forensically linking Amanda Knox to this crime. And, of course, we have a knife that they say is the murder weapon, where I know Dr. Kobolinski's looked at this with respect to there not even being enough to analyze on the tip of Meredith Kircher. That's not definitively linked to Meredith Kircher, and in fact didn't even match an outline of a knife there at the scene and didn't match the wounds.
Now, the knife that was found, we have somebody, Gary from Dakota, in the chat room asking, why are people saying DNA was found on the knife in her boyfriend's, I would assume, boyfriend's apartment, right? He didn't live in that cottage, is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Okay,
it would be off of the premises. So why, if you're stating that Raphael's, you stated about DNA in the bra fastener, that was Raphael's. And again, it almost appears, at least in my opinion, that there's some stuff being planted here, because this 47 days later, now all of a sudden you're finding this young man's DNA in the bra fastener, that I would have thought would have been found a lot sooner than that. But then to say his DNA was on a knife found in his own apartment, why would he take the knife back to his apartment?
They said it was Amanda's DNA on the knife. It was a cooking knife, a kitchen knife, that the police transported from Raffaele's house in a shoebox.
Yeah, can I weigh in? Sure,
yeah,
Michelle.
Yeah, please do, because that just, you know, if you're going to do a crime, why take the weapon with you?
Absolutely. I mean, that Anne has described this very, very well. There doesn't appear to be a good reason for why somebody who committed such a heinous crime would take the murder weapon back to their home. If anything, it probably would have been discarded someplace. That's first. Secondly, the wounds on Meredith Kircher are simply not consistent. At least two of the wounds are not consistent with that kitchen knife. They have a different conformation. And although when you look at wounds, because the skin is elastic, you're limited in what you can say. It does appear that this may not have been the weapon, probably was not. I think perhaps even eliminated as the weapon that created at least two of the cut marks on Meredith Kircher. The DNA testing that was done in this case It's somewhat questionable that they used a procedure where you're looking at less than what we say the amount of 100 picograms, which means you're in a zone it's called stochastic problems, and what that means is you can get results that need to be properly interpreted. Mr. Sollecito was Amanda's boyfriend, and so she was in that apartment, and she may very well have touched that particular kitchen knife. It could have been innocently, it could have her DNA, and in fact, it is even possible that she could have transferred Meredith Kircher's DNA onto that knife. So for a number of reasons, that knife may just simply be a red herring. The fact that they used this low copy number type of testing is also something to be very concerned about. The bra fastener, and Ann pointed out that it was almost 6 weeks before the police returned the second time to find that item of evidence because they realized it was missing from the bra. The first time they went there, they retrieved the bra but did not have that small piece that was removed, cut off from the bra. That is the piece that supposedly has Mr. Sollecito's DNA as well as three other people that have not yet been identified. So there are lots of questions about this. The footprint using luminol. Luminol is a presumptive test, not a confirmatory test, and I think is pointing out that there are problems with the interpretation of this physical evidence.
And this is
Go ahead, Christine.
You know, the defense still has not received the documentation on how all of this testing was done. We have not received all of the complete procedures that were done, the protocols, the documents that support how they went about testing all of this stuff.
This is absolutely, to an American, we would be shocked because we have with discovery laws. But we're now in a trial in Italy where the rules of the game are different. I know when I handle major cases, I am entitled to look at procedures, quality control, quality assurance, to look at the notes taken by the crime scene people, by the lab people, and not having that puts the defense at a tremendous disadvantage.
Well, and the
how
fact
different
that there
is forensics, Dr. Kobylinski, from our traditional ways here in the United States compared to that of Italy?
Well, the basic rules must be followed. You know, going to a scene, documenting it, identifying evidence, again, documenting it, and collecting it, preserving it, packaging it, et cetera, chain of custody. Those are the basic rules. But when I observed the tape of the crime scene investigation team, it certainly appeared that there were some unusual kinds of procedures. Also, you know, once you abandon a scene, you never know if things are going to change. I mean, you often don't have a second opportunity to go back. So we usually do the job the correctly the first way. We limit the number of people at the scene. There were an awful lot of people going through the home. They did wear protective garb. But they worked with evidence. They handled it far too much. There were a number of differences that I observed in actual procedure. But the basic procedure was followed.
Dr. Archer, are you on with us?
I am officially here, yes.
Well, welcome, Dr. Archer. Let me ask you, before we move into witnesses and further DNA evidence that's lacking in this case, what's the mindset of a young lady, I believe was 20 at the time, you know, she sees nothing wrong with the house and goes in, and then all of a sudden she's faced with the fact that they're accusing her of murder. Can you give our listeners a little bit of an insight of how detrimental this has become and why possibly her story may have changed, and then we'll go to Anne in regards to her original statements.
Well, I think that the interesting thing about this case is I think that it is psychologically adversely affected everyone that's been involved with it. And I certainly would think that in her particular scenario, of course, you come upon this situation, there's been a brutal murder, you're upset, you're distraught, you're devastated, but the one thing that we know without question is that everyone is going to go through not only the stages of grief in the same way, but also a reaction to a severe stress is very, very individualized and personal. And so we like to think that, oh, there's a normal process that everyone goes through when they're faced with a horrific event, and that's just not the case. And so we get into trouble when we try to normalize this and say, okay, well, her reactions are not what we would expect. That, you can't say that. And so I think in this particular scenario, I don't really read anything into the fact that her story changed. I mean, coupled that with the fact that she was supposedly smoking, by her own admission, hashish at the time, at the evening when the event occurred, and I think that it makes it very complicated across the board. But, you know, I guess that when I look at this, I flash back to the Natalie Holloway situation, and mm-hmm. it seems to me that you have a police force here and a prosecutor's office here that were well aware of that case and knew they had a high-profile case of their own and made the decision from day one that they were going to find a perpetrator and get a conviction regardless and put this to rest. They weren't going to have a situation like Aruba where this thing dragged on for months and then years. And so time after time here, I just see repeated examples where you're proven guilty, and only if you can find enough evidence to prove otherwise, then you will be guilty.
Her family and I spoke last night. Christina, you might want to weigh in on this, or Janet. You know, it's almost, I'm seeing a duplication of another case that we're all familiar with, but it's almost as if it's character assassination, and that's what they're basing everything on and hoping that she gets prosecuted because of that. Because right now there is no evidence, and it took, how long did it take, Christina, for you all to have access to see what was going on and what they had on your niece?
Oh, almost over a year. I mean, and we still don't to this day have all of the information. Toward the trial during July, we actually finally received videotape recordings that they've had for months that really proved that Amanda wasn't going to flee the country. She was talking with her aunt in Germany, where she was going. Her aunt offered her a place to stay. Oh, come, you know, let us help you. You know, you're very upset, and come here just for a little while, just to get your you know, bearings and recoup from this, and then go back. But she really wanted to stay and help. And this was information that the police had from day one that could have been used in her pre-trials, where she possibly could have been at least put out on house arrest, because part of the reason that she is currently in prison is because they, you know, tied this fleeing, that she could flee and that she was going to flee the country. Well, we have proof, and the police had proof, that she had no intention of fleeing the country.
Well, I don't think that would happen too much here in the United States, because without the forensic evidence or some type of evidence to prove one may be guilty of something, usually an arrest doesn't occur. Is that correct, Dan?
Absolutely. And the fact of the matter, I was just thinking of, you know, all the publicity in this case and the pressure the prosecutors seem to be feeling, and the authorities, and like Dale said too, is to make this thing play out, which is just devastating for Amanda, because there is no evidence. There's nothing to convict her, but yet here we are, you know, 2 years later.
Italy
why
has
are they,
a very big
why aren't they going to a, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, this is Janet. Italy has a very big, you have to save face, we're already in this deep,
yes.
And we can't back out now because it would look bad for us, so they just have to keep going, even if they don't have anything, just so they don't save, they don't lose their face.
Yeah. Honor.
What I don't seem to understand is Amanda signed two statements. of the morning of November 6th. Obviously, we just heard from Dr. Archer and how distraught this young lady could be, and we can't judge one on their actions or what they're doing or not crying or laughing or what have you, as we've seen in many cases, even here in the United States. But the court ruled that the second statement could not be used into evidence because of the time that she had signed it. What do you any comment on that portion of the case in general, Ann?
This is I think the most disputed area and the most I think misrepresented in terms of what we've seen in the press. Amanda did not speak enough Italian to order a pizza or ask for the bathroom once.
Exactly.
Yet she was questioned without an interpreter and without a lawyer over 41 hours. There was one session that was 14 hours overnight. But the most important thing in this, besides that, is that what they asked her, what they keep talking about, is this time when she said, "I would have covered my ears." That was the prosecutor, who, by the way, is under indictment, but the prosecutor's saying, visualize what it would have been like if you were there. You know, imagine what it would have been like. And she said, I hear screaming, "I would have covered my ears." That's it. They've called it a confession. We've had statements ruled to be inadmissible by the Supreme Court of Italy, and physical force was used. You know, in America, we have the Miranda rule, which is you're advised your right to counsel. You're advised that you don't have to give a statement. And the fact of the law in our state or in our country is you can't have coerced statements, which clearly this was, but then it was, she was being asked to imagine something. There's a book called The Monster of Florence by Douglas Preston where he describes exactly that type of interrogation by the same prosecutor, and he couldn't stand up to it. So, you know, the fact of the matter is she never confessed.
Well, you know, she's never confessed, but I believe somebody did confess in a very social atmosphere with a friend on Skype or something of that
That's
nature,
right. Mm-hmm.
In regards to the crime, and basically even stated that Raphael and Amanda weren't even around, that they were out. So when you look at a confession, if you will, to a friend like that, and then you go into the fact that his DNA, we're speaking of Rudy, the gentleman that's already arrested here, his DNA was found inside Meredith's body and on her clothing, and his fingerprint was in her purse, almost to say that he had his way with her and then went for her money. At least from my point of view, that's the way I'm reading into this. So when you have all of that evidence against one person, and then now all of a sudden he changes his tune and the courts are listening to him, I don't get that.
His statement was Amanda had nothing to do with this, and it was on Skype, and it was voluntary, and he has a parallel appeal right now, but the jurors aren't sequestered, so they could well see, and the judges, they could well see what's being reported about his most recent statement about being in the bathroom when this thing happened.
I was just going to weigh in on this, and I think that whenever I analyze any type of case like this, I always, in addition to analyzing it, I always like to look at, okay, what are the lessons learned? What can the other folks listening today learn from this? And really, there's just one thing that's overwhelmingly clear, that if you were involved in a scenario like this in a foreign country, I think that her relatives and family were right. She needed to get the heck out of Italy and
Absolutely.
Back to America and deal with the ramifications over here rather than there. Because, you know, this is just looking like such a railroading job from the start. And had she been in America, then they would have had to present proof in order to extradite her over there, which it doesn't sound like any of this would have qualified for that. And I think she could have fought it very well from over here. Now she's in their system playing ball on their court. And I just really have a bad feeling about the whole thing. I mean, I just think that it's taken on a life of its own. And now everyone that's involved wants to close this case the easiest way possible. And unfortunately, that's looking like that could end up being a conviction.
And one of the family members, we did try and try to get her to, you know, at least go to Germany for a little while just to, you know, because it's a sad and tragic thing. Here her roommate was murdered and she was there when the body was discovered and, you know, it's terrible. Take a semester off from school and, you know, get out of there and then you go back to school. No, none of us ever really imagined that she would be even a suspect in this case. So, you know, we wanted her to come home or go to Germany just so she could relax and kind of wind down and get her head wrapped around this. I don't think any of us were trying to get her out of there because we thought that she was going to be, you know, this deep involved in this and that they were going to think she had something to do with it.
I know, but the scenario is very, very simple that, of course, you couldn't have known that at the time. I don't think any of us really would have thought along those lines at the time. But in hindsight, I think that if this were to happen to me or someone I know in a foreign country down the road, the first thing I would say is, you know, I don't care whether you had nothing to do with it. I don't care about any of that. You got to get out of that country because it just their laws are different. Their culture is different. Every aspect of what you're dealing with is foreign to us in every way, shape, and form. And if you got to deal with it, and if you are a suspect, then deal with it from the United States, where at least you're going to be protected somewhat by our laws and not at the whims of another country's laws. So I'm just saying that going forward, I think it's a valuable lesson for anyone that's listening or anyone that knows about this case in retrospect to say, okay, I understand now if this were to happen. Yeah, this is what I would do.
You bet.
I agree.
What can be done at this point legally to have a voice for justice for Amanda and Raphael and to get them out of there? Is there anything or is the results going to be final when they go finish the trial?
Well, you know, we hear a lot from other Italians that most cases are won on appeal. That, you know, don't be surprised if she's found guilty because they'll let her go and find her innocent at appeal. That's just the way things work. We've heard that quite a bit. So, you know, our hopes are we're cautiously optimistic, hoping that, you know, maybe they will just find her innocent at this stage due to lack of evidence and everything else. But, you know, we also know that if that's not the way that it goes, that, you know, we still have a chance at appeal because that's what the Italians say, is that everybody's, you know, when in this situation, you're found innocent at appeal, not at the first level.
You're found innocent at an appeal, then let me ask you, Anne, would you still have grounds for anything against the people that actually staged? I believe it was on your website that showed evidence of the crime scene might have been staged. If there's proof to show that, would they have any ability to seek restitution on that?
Well, there's always an ability to bring a civil action, but I think that what's more important now is for Amanda Knox to be able to win this case now, you know, on the merits, and an appeal will take a lot of time, and she's not precluded from any kind of a civil action by virtue, you know, depending on what happens here. But I think that when we look at legally, what can we do? You know, the State Department could have intervened earlier when she was being held without being charged for a year, because here it would only be 72 hours. So it would be a question of, you know, a potential violation of her rights or human rights as an American citizen abroad. Now, that would be a place where there could have been at least, you know, some kind of an intervention or at least some examination, you know, of the case.
And they didn't?
You know what? Not, you know, Janet and Christina can chime in on this, but we've heard different things about different people making inquiries, but, you know, to the extent of something happening that was definitive, we can see the result. She's in trial. But the trial's more difficult, of course, because Italy's a sovereign nation. We have comity of nations. You know, we have to respect the laws of another nation. Amanda has two defense attorneys who have been defending her now throughout this whole trial. But I hope it doesn't have to go to an appeal, but I've heard the same thing, that the Italians say the appeals are more successful oftentimes.
Pretty sad.
It is very sad.
Everybody's lying through all of this.
Yeah, we've been hearing that the Justice Department and you know, all of these other United States organizations, they are watching and waiting. That's all that we're getting from them right now, is that they're watching and waiting. They have to respect the Italian justice system and let this play out. And then we hear if she is found guilty, that then they will step in and do something. We don't know what that something is, but, you know, that's the little piece of cheese they're hanging out in front of us. If she's found guilty, they might do something.
If she's found guilty, wow, I don't know if that's justice.
Yeah.
You know, if you believe your own American citizen has been set up and everything's been staged in this case, I would think that we would all want our State Department to back us and get us out of there, but that's me.
I think most Americans are under that illusion that if you go to a foreign country and you get in trouble, that, you know, the Americans will swoop in with their helicopters and rescue you.
Right, like with Lisa Lang's sister.
Yeah, exactly. We have about 20 minutes left. I want to speak with a little bit Janet and Christina. Christina, we spoke in depth last night, and, you know, I heard a different side of it that we haven't, as viewers of media and such, have not been able to hear from. And I want you and Janet to have this opportunity of talking with our listeners. If anyone wants to call in, of course, and ask your questions, the number is 347-838-8622. And Dr. Dale Archer and Dr. Kobolinski and Attorney Ann Bremner are still on the line as well. But so much has happened with this case. And, yes, it affects you emotionally, spiritually, and all of that. But in the end, financially, it's broken your family. And you've had to do such creative things in order to keep this going and to make sure somebody is always with Amanda, which I find so awesome. So can you talk a little bit about that and say whatever you'd like? Plead
sure.
The websites are listed on our website too. Friendsofamanda.org and AmandaDefenseFund.org can be found on the website too. But go ahead, Christina.
Well, you know, it's like people have asked us. You know, they didn't know if they would actually be able to do this type of support for their daughter. And you know, my sister and I, we looked at each other, and it's like, how would you not? You know, she's innocent. She had nothing to do with this. And so what else can you do? You have to make sacrifices. We want to be there for her because we are her connection. Family is very important to us. We all live close together. So, you know, we've done what we've had to do to make sure that she's protected and she's being taken care of.
It wasn't even really a discussion of should we do this. It was so X. You know, it wasn't really an option to not have somebody there for her while she's there. We were not going to abandon her, leave her there to deal with this on her own. It's not an option.
And, you know, we were actually hopeful in the pretrial, to be honest with you, that there was no evidence and everything that we could see, there was no reason to actually send this to trial. And we were pretty devastated when that event happened. And now we had to really dig in and look at the long term. You know, we have an apartment, a very small apartment that we rent in Perugia. We have a car that was donated and sent down from Germany to Perugia so that because we were paying astronomical prices for renting a car because we had to get around. It's, you know, it's just all of those things. It's like living abroad as well as trying to live at home and always have somebody there.
Janet, have you been over to Italy as well?
Yeah, the last time I was there was last Christmas at time. Just after Christmas for New Year's, I was there with Etta. My husband just got back from there last week. He was there for about a month.
And Christina, you're going back at Thanksgiving?
Yeah, my sister Etta and I and Kurt and Cassandra will be flying back on Thanksgiving to be present for the last couple of days of closing arguments and to be there for the verdict.
Okay, and we spoke in regards to the translator that she had a couple months ago. I take it that they'll have a better one this time?
No, unfortunately, she is that's the translator that has been assigned to her. We don't have a choice about that. We can provide input to the judge that if we're not happy, but for the most part, Amanda is so now well-versed in Italian that
right.
she She speaks fluently herself, and you know, during her testimony, she was she did an amazing job for herself in representing, you know, her voice.
She sure did. You also mentioned last night that, you know, Amanda can get cards, so many, and that you bring them over there. Can you mention that to the listeners, and so that we can make sure that she has a nice care package for the holidays?
Sure. On our website, we created on the AmandaDefenseFund.org site, there's a P.O. box that's there, and we like people have been sending, you know, paperback books, CDs that they think that she might be interested, writing letters. And since there's always somebody in the family there, we and usually at a month at a time, somebody's always going over, we send that over and we get them into her. She is limited to the number of items that can go in during the course of a month, as we are limited on the amount of visitations that we can have. We only get to see her for 1 hour twice a week, so 2 hours during a full week, and then we're limited to only six times during the month. So in order to make sure that she gets what she needs, a lot of people have been very supportive of sending their letters and like I said, books and CDs to the P.O. box that we have created, and we get them into her. Because when we bring things in, we also try to bring in food items that, you know, is not common in the prison, so that she has, you know, things that she enjoys. You know, avocados was a great one. She misses them, and it's something that is so simple, but yet she just, you know, devours them when we bring them in. And those are the types of things that we do for her.
And she's such a sweet kid. She asks for us to bring things if we can in for her roommates and to share with those that, you know, have nobody that's in the prison, bringing or giving them anything. She asked for us to, can you please bring my roommate a hat or a pair of some sheets or something? And we try to do what we can for those that she's staying with, just because it makes her life more comfortable while she's there.
I wanted
Has she been
to
able
just,
to? Go ahead, Doctor.
Yeah, I just wanted to. I'm just curious how she's holding up psychologically through all of this. I mean, to be in a foreign prison with limited contact with her loved family and loved ones, and facing a scenario which could put her in prison for life, obviously, if she was convicted. I just wondered how her mental state is at this point.
You know, she's
actually, Amanda,
remarkably stoic. Wouldn't you agree, Christina? I mean, she is scared. She's not ignorant to what the possibilities are, but she's such a kind of a free spirit, everything will always work out, you know, they can't possibly convict me because I didn't do it, and the truth is the truth, and, you know, they have to go with that. So she's I don't know if you would call her naive, a lot of us have, but she's remarkably strong and hopeful. I don't think that this has damaged her in any way. I think, if anything, it's made her realize that not everybody has your best intentions for you. And that's the way she always has been. She's always so almost hippie-ish, we would tease her, because she always, you know, everything was always about peace and love, and everyone was always good, and no one would ever purposely do you harm. I think she's lost a little bit of that. She's not jaded, though, or mad or anything. She still honestly believes that she will get out of there, because there just really is no other option.
And
so she sounds like she's holding up.
Would you go? Oh, sorry, Doctor.
Yes.
I was just going to briefly say it sounds like she's holding up perhaps better than you guys are with the stress.
Yeah, and that she knows that. I think she's more concerned about her family than herself, as far as our mental status and the toll it's taking on everyone here. You know, mostly her grandmother. She's worried about how she's dealing with it, and because, you know, and her mom, and she's more worried about that than she is about herself.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Amanda views that time has sort of stood still for her. She focuses on her studies. She's been fortunate that, you know, she's been able to do some long-distance correspondence with the University of Washington and still, you know, feel like that she is participating and focusing on her studies. And those are the things that, you know, we try to reinforce to her that here's an opportunity. You can focus on that. Don't worry about anything else at this point, because there isn't a lot that she can do. She has to rely on her lawyers, and she has to go through the process. And so we try to just make sure that she is, you know, that she's feeling positive, that she, and she does have her down moments. And I don't want anybody to be illusioned that she doesn't. She at times gets, you know, pretty down, but she tries to pick herself up and you know, regain her focus on just, you know, just getting through this process.
Yeah.
With the Dr. Kobylinski,
yes.
In regards to the outcome,
mm-hmm.
if this case, you know, comes to an end,
mm-hmm.
do you see it, you know, going into our favor and having Amanda home soon? Or
yeah.
do you see, you know, based on the forensics, they're
mm-hmm.
not there, correct?
Well, Michelle, let me say this. I really do believe in science, and I think science is a good way to reach out for justice. However, that, you know, in order for that to be correct, I think the integrity of the evidence has to be maintained. The crime scene investigation has to be done properly. The testing has to be done in a reliable way. The expert testimony has to be done accurately. The reconstruction or the interpretation of the evidence, you know, all of this has to come together. And then I think this jury, we have two professional judges and six lay people. I think if they listen to facts, they will come to the right decision. But it, as Ann pointed out, if they're going to hear issues, if they're going to hear about physical evidence and there are problems, then they may come to the wrong conclusion. Quite frankly, I think that the prosecution has built up a case that I think lay people could actually fall for. I am fearful that she will be convicted. I hope not, but it looks to me like that's a strong possibility, and I do hope that all of the protections that exist there will be utilized. I certainly hope the defense will have an opportunity to look at all the procedures and all the discovery and then be able to mount the case that they really need to mount. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but I'm very concerned.
And
what also is worrisome for us, sorry, is that even if she is found innocent, the prosecutor has the right to appeal that.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Yes.
Mm. Well, that's not good. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Ann, do you agree with Dr. Kobylinski on what we're dealing with here?
I do, and I have huge respect for Dr. Kobylinski, and I've used the same words. That's cautiously optimistic. Given that also that we've heard just a lot of maligning of her character, to the kind of evidence we'd never allow in U.S. courts, to try and this ritualistic slaying, I mean, it's just been so salacious and demonizing in the press, tabloid press, and by the prosecution, especially in their leaks of evidence. And these jurors aren't sequestered. I mean, they can read whatever is there in Perugia.
And the family, are you cautiously optimistic as well, or do you feel that evidence will prevail?
We're both.
I'm shocked at every turn of this case. Every time it goes further, we're just blown away. So, but I think now we're kind of at the point that it's got to end sometime. It cannot possibly continue to go on with the lack of evidence that they have, but we've been feeling that way this whole time, and they continue to surprise us by continuing to push this further and further. So I think we've become a little bit jaded in knowing that it is a distinct possibility that they will find her guilty of something. We're hopeful that it's something small, because they do have the time served thing there where, you know, yes, we think she's guilty of knowing something, and that's a two-year sentence, time served, she goes home. You know, we could live with that, but if it's something more than that, that's going to be really hard to deal with.
Do you know what they're going after?
They're throwing everything at the wall, and I think, and just seeing what might stick.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me as well. You know, you can't, you know, you have one person serving time and you've got two people that you're accusing. Somebody murdered this young woman, but, you know, you've got somebody that's DNA is all over the room and in her purse and everything else, and yet you're going after two people whose DNA is really nowhere.
Right.
So it really, to me, it's a cut and dry kind of case. But, you know, again, it is in Italy. Cost factor, Christina, you know, cards are great. Can somebody in the chat room is asking, can Amanda, like if you're serving time here in America, people can actually send you money? Is that the same way it is over there? Does she need money in jail?
Oh, yeah, she does need money in jail. You can't send it to her. It won't get there, I can tell you that. If people want to make a donation, that's why we set up the Amanda Defense Fund. You know,
right.
They can send checks to the P.O. box, or they can use PayPals to make, you know, donations on a credit card. There's also the opportunity to make, you know, donate air miles. I mean, we're flying back and forth, and that's a huge expenditure.
So, folks listening, please go to Amanda DefenseFund.org. You can donate your air mileage. I believe you have it set up both for your sister and also Kurt.
Yep.
Okay. And so if you have any questions, the contact information is on that site. Anne, is that your site, friendsofamanda.org?
It is. And what we've done, we encourage your viewers and listeners to get on our site, because we put out all the evidence up there. We put it up there objectively, and people can get on there and see what's really happening in the Amanda Knox, the real truth in her case.
And what can listeners do to have a voice for justice in this particular case? I mean, until today, I didn't realize that the State Department has really just hung this young lady out to dry. And it makes us all wonder, you know, traveling abroad, really, nobody is watching our back. So what can we do as citizens of America to band together and help have justice for this young lady?
Go ahead.
Write their congressmen, write their senators, write people and tell them, you know, just...
Write Obama. I mean...
Yeah, please.
Write,
yeah. Write Hillary. Write everybody you can and just say we're astounded by what's been happening with this case. Please do something to help this girl. The more people that are letting our government know how astounded and appalled we are that this is going on, the better chance we have of getting some kind of help from the United States government.
Somebody in the chat line said, why don't we just pull in Bill Clinton to go over and get her?
I know. It's a great idea.
If it was only that simple. I mean,
right.
I believe
exactly.
Lisa's sister was over there quite a while before she was rescued. But, again, you know, you can't expect it to happen by itself. And that's the power of a voice. So hopefully everyone will get out there. We have a few minutes, folks. If anyone, we have many people in the chat line. If you want to call in, 347-838-8622. Any last thoughts, Dr. Kobolinski?
Well, this is a tough case. If you're, as we're saying, if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you just happen to get caught up in the criminal justice system, you can be totally 100% innocent and yet be dragged through the system. It is economically devastating, and anything can happen. We have 240 people that are falsely, that have been incorrectly convicted, and thank heavens, the Innocence Project out of New York City, they've been able to exonerate these people. We make mistakes in this country, but there are safeguards. I can't even imagine what happens to Americans that are caught up in the criminal justice system in another country. So I'm hoping that justice will be done and that the jury will do the right thing, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Dr. Archer, any last thoughts?
Yeah, I guess, obviously,
or
looking
advice,
at it.
I should say.
Well, I mean, I'm concerned. I mean, I think that I obviously look at these from the psychological perspective of the entire case. I'm just very, very concerned in this case that there's such a vested interest with the prosecutors, with the police, with the country, in order to put this to rest and to get this conviction, to prove to the world that, hey, you know, we were right and we had the evidence and we had this all along. And I think that for them, the saving face may well be, okay, we're going to get the conviction and then it will be overturned on appeal. But the sad part of that is, of course, just another year or two or three, however long it takes, of Amanda being in jail. So that's my big concern for the entire thing going forward.
Anne, any last thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that we have an innocent abroad here from Seattle, and that I agree. Call, you know, write to Obama, you know, Clinton. You know, we've got to do something. It's not just Seattle; it's this whole country that we've got someone that went abroad working three jobs to go study, and she ends up in an Italian prison, you know, facing potentially the rest of her life in jail on a case that doesn't have evidence. There isn't evidence. And so I think that anything that can be done, you know, if we do nothing, you know, it's something that we'll all have to live with. We all need to do something to help Amanda Knox. It could be anyone's child.
And that's a good point, because when you think about it, she was only there less than 2 months, you know, when all this took place. To think that she decided to pack up and head for Italy to only do a crime like this and have her world come crashing down is really ridiculous thinking.
Well, and it's something we call it the Magnini Express. Magnini is the name of the prosecutor, you know, and he's someone, of course, who's under indictment, and we can't forget that. In Duke LaCrosse, the prosecutor was under indictment, but it happened at the end. Knife bomb, and he was convicted and disbarred. Magnini is indicted now for abuse of office.
Any last thoughts? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. I'm done. Thanks.
Any last thoughts, Christina or Janet?
Yeah, you know, Michelle, I would like to, one, just thank everybody that has tried to help Amanda and the family.
It's huge. We really are astounded at the amount of outpouring of just well wishes and generosity from complete strangers all across the country and the world. We've received some letters and donations from all over the world, all these different countries who only know Amanda from what has been put on, you know, their TV or their newspapers, and they felt enough pull to reach out and get a word to her. It's been amazing. We're so grateful for that.
Well, folks, again, the websites are on our website at blogtalkradio.com/helpingheroes. Visit friendsofamanda.org or amandadefensefund.org and have that voice for justice. Thank you for everyone joining us today. You can have a voice for Amanda. Visit the site again and see how you can send a card, money, other ways of having a helping hand in this particular case. Our next show is next Wednesday, when we welcome the CEO and founder of Blog Talk Radio, Alan Levy. And all of us can have a voice for justice. What will you be doing this week to make a difference? So until we meet again, thank you, everyone, for joining us, and let's have a voice for Amanda. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.